and welcome to episode 2 of Think Omnichannel, the podcast that sets to demystify the world of Omnichannel by engaging with thought leaders and unboxing products and services that truly enable Omnichannel experience. I'm your host, Graham Johnston, and I'm delighted with all the great feedback we had on episode 1, which is still available to listen to, by the way. And today we've got an absolutely brilliant episode with two fantastic guests. Delighted to welcome to the podcast Martin Newman and Carl Scheibel. So let me introduce my two guests today. Martin, as you probably know, as the consumer champion, he is also the founder of CustomerServiceAction.com and the Customer First Group. And Martin is a force for positive change for both consumers and brands. He's a consistent advocate for consumer rights, as well as keeping diversity, social responsibility and employee engagement top of the agenda in his media appearances and through all of the content he produces on his TV and his podcast channels. And on that point, you've probably seen him on BBC TV and radio, Sky, ITV, Channel 5, and a host of other media channels such as LBC, The Times, FT, to discuss various issues relating to retail, travel, casual dining, automotive and financial service sectors. But despite all of those high-profile invitations, he has said that appearing on Think Omnichannel is absolutely the highlight. Welcome, Martin.
Exactly. It's the pinnacle of my career, Graham.
I know it is, Martin. Listen, thank you for joining us today. And joining us also is Carl Scheibel. Carl is a seasoned fintech veteran with over 20 years of leadership experience in technology, financial services and payments. Carl is currently the CEO of Clearpay Finance Limited, which is a subsidiary of Afterpay, a pay-later fintech leader revolutionising payments on three continents. Previously, Carl founded and was CEO of KeyPay Limited and has also held the EVP position within EMEA for MoneyGram and has held a variety of leadership positions at PayPal, most recently serving as VP and Managing Director, UK and Ireland. So welcome along, Carl.
Great to be here. Thank you.
No, thank you. It's fantastic to have you on board. So today's podcast is all about customer centricity and how to drive customer-centric transformation within an omnichannel world. So two better people to discuss this I could not think of, and it's great to have you both on board. So before we get into the topic of customer centricity within omnichannel, I think it would be best for you both to give a bit of an overview of your own experience and careers. I tried to do that, but I'm sure you guys can do that far more articulately than I could. So I'm going to start with you, Martin. Give us an overview.
I don't know if I could do a better job than you just done, Graham, but thank you very much for the fantastic introduction. Maybe just a couple of things to add. I have the privilege of being on the advisory board of Clearpay. I've been involved with Clearpay and Afterpay for the last couple of years, actually, which I really love. I love what they're doing in the payment space, but I'll leave Carl to talk more about that throughout the podcast. I also have the privilege of being the non-executive chairman of the retail arm of the Scouts, which is a personal passion, having been a Cub and a Scout many, many years ago. Love being involved with that organization again in this day and age. So those are some of the things that I do alongside my day job, which, as you rightly pointed out, is trying to drive positive change for both consumers and brands. So that manifests itself in a number of different ways, from sometimes doing a bit of advisory and consulting support to retailers and brands and telling them how to be more customer-centric, how to go about that journey. We'll talk about some of that today. And sometimes it's just giving them advice that we are getting from consumers about how they can do a better job of serving them. I have a website called Customer Service Action, and we essentially capture on a daily basis dozens of complaints, sometimes compliments, about brands. And our job is to connect the customer with a brand. Hopefully, they'll do something about resolving the particular issue the customer has. But obviously, they get a lot of insight from that, and it tells them, you know, maybe where they're going wrong in customer service and what they could do to serve customers, you know, more effectively. And over time, we will be looking to integrate that technology more and more into the actual brand's own website. So they have a frontline customer service solution that enables them to really deliver more transparent and more effective customer service than arguably they can do at the moment.
Brilliant and really refreshing. And we'll delve into a little bit more later. But I love the fact that you offer up the opportunity for customers to give compliments about brands as well. A lot of these websites just are focused on maybe complaints. So it's great to see that you're balancing that with praise as well. So fantastic. Thank you very much, Martin. And Carl, I'm sure you can do a better job of explaining a little bit more about your background and your career to everybody.
Well, I can explain and tell you how it all comes together. I'm obviously, first of all, the odd person out here, not being Scottish, with Graham and Martin, both of you with charming accents. Despite my American accent, I'm actually Norwegian. So I think Norway and Scotland are very similar in many ways. And so we have that in common. I am rightly, as you pointed out, the payments expert here. I've spent the better part of two decades, really since the beginning of the commercial internet, in the online world, and most of that on the payment side, about half of that time spent at PayPal. And if I'm the payments person and Martin is the consumer champion, where both of those worlds intersect is with the retailer and with retail. And so speaking to you today about the consumer and about retail and about payments, you know, and all of that in a digital and a physical world, omni-channel intersection is going to be a good recipe for half an hour.
Brilliant. Yeah, and we're really looking forward to it because payments is such an integral part of an omni-channel experience. You know, without the payments, then, you know, the journey can't end. So really great to get your insights on that. So we'll leading neatly on from that is something that I have done and will be asking all of my guests on this series of podcasts is to sort of demystify the word omnichannel and really kind of give your own explanation to what omnichannel means, your own version of it. So I'm going to come to you first, Martin. The word omnichannel, what does it mean?
Well, I think you know me quite well, Graham, and I'm not the biggest fan of buzzwords, but I would say of all the buzzwords that do the rounds in retail and multi-channel, I think omnichannel is something that, you know, does resonate with me. I think from my perspective, I do see the world largely through the lens of our consumer. And I think what it really means is giving the customer the ability to essentially, you know, have a seamless customer experience across all the touch points of an organization. Customers should never know or even hear the word channel, quite frankly, because it doesn't mean anything to them. So it's a descriptor for us in the business to describe the type of joined up experience that we're trying to give our consumers. And ultimately, it's really at the heart of it, it's about consumer empowerment. So it's really about letting customers choose where they start their journey and choose where they end their journey. In other words, some people are researching online, still buying offline. Some people are buying offline, but having it shipped straight to their house, for example. Or they might be buying online and then clicking and collecting rather than having it, you know, delivered when they might not be in. It's more convenient for them to be able to pick an order up at a store when it's been clicked and collected. And it also gives them the ability to change their mind when they pick their order up if they find actually what they've ordered isn't quite right. So it really is about consumer empowerment. That's how I can define it.
Love it. Thank you. Excellent. And what about yourself, Carl?
Well, I think I agree. And I think the key word here is the consumer. The consumer is at the front and center of everything that we do. It's at the front and center of anything that a retailer does, a payment provider or service provider, because without the consumer, you know, there's nothing to buy or sell. So I think the important thing from a payments perspective, if you think about anything in life, it's not always one thing to all people all the time. I think, you know, sometimes we walk, sometimes we run, sometimes we take a bicycle, a motorcycle, a car, a bus, a plane, a train. You know, we do these things in different instances. And the same is true with food. We eat one thing one day and one thing the next day. All of it is still food. And I think when it comes to payments, we use, in the old days, we used to use cash for everything. Then there was a check, there's a bank transfer, there's a Visa card, an Amex card, a MasterCard, a debit card, a credit card, there's PayPal, and now there's Buy Now, Pay Later and ClearPay. These are all choices that are available to us. And at certain points, we have preferences to use certain things at different times. And I think it's our job as ClearPay and Afterpay is to be available where the consumer wants to use us. And whether that is on a merchant website, which is a large merchant, or a merchant website, which is an SMB, or like Martin says, in the physical world, at the checkout counter, in a store, you know, we want to service that consumer and allow them to make that purchase in the way that they want at that time. when you, that's omnichannel. And if you overlay actually time, because none of this is happening, I think, in a vacuum. If you think about the internet and how we used to shop online, and then there was the physical world. And of course, all this stuff has converged with mobile phones and with technology. And this is becoming rather seamless. And you have the monster of all online giants, Amazon, operating in the physical world. And of course, you have the physical retailers going online and the intersection of both, and then allowing the consumer the flexibility of, you know, researching online, but shopping in the physical world, or shopping online and returning in the physical world, etc. So the intersection of all this stuff, the convergence of digital and physical, it really is just one thing. It's retail, it's shopping, it's consumer preference, whether you call it omnichannel or whatever you want to call it.
Wonderful. Yeah, two brilliant descriptions. And I think just, you know, picking up on what you said there at the end around convergence, it is, you know, there's a lot of convergence, and that has been the sort of trend, and it's been accelerated over the last little while, certainly the last sort of 6 to 8 months, which we'll touch on later in the podcast. But I think essentially what we're talking about is previously retail was quite straightforward. You know, there was some very straightforward journeys that people took in terms of the channels they shopped in, and it was a start and end in that channel. And now the complex nature of all those different journeys, it's growing and growing and growing. But actually the art for businesses is to try and make that the most seamless it can possibly seem to the customer, while in the back end it's very complex in terms of the journeys that happen, and at what part do different elements of that journey come in. But essentially, I think what both of you said was around, you know, customer empowerment, control, choice, and essentially where that lands for me really is customer centricity. And I think that's the whole point of today's podcast, is really sort of picking in on that customer centricity point. So Martin, if I'll come to you first on this point. So, you know, you've just done a white paper on customer centricity, and it's an amazing read. It's very detailed but very actionable. So I'm a big fan of Blinkist, where you can get you know, a kind of condensed version of a great book and in a short space of time. Can you give us the sort of Blinkist style version of what that report actually says?
I'll do my best. I mean, essentially, the way, I think, segueing from what you were saying a minute ago, you know, what one thing that I think a lot of businesses haven't really grappled with yet at the top of the business is the fundamental shift, and that is that prior to 1994, prior to, you know, the first e-commerce transaction, the retailer held the balance of power. You know, you had, as a consumer, limited choice. You had high street stores, you had shopping malls, you might have had the odd catalogue that you could buy from. And then, of course, the advent of e-commerce began what I would call the democratization of retail. And that's led to a place where we are today, where, as a consumer, we all have so much choice at our fingertip. And that means that our level of expectations around service and everything to do with service and experience have obviously gone off the chart. And I think that brands have struggled to keep up with that. And part of the reason for that is that almost all businesses treat customer service as a cost center and not a profit center. And that's kind of, that whole concept is alien to me, because what you're basically saying is, on the P&L, customers are a cost, they're not a benefit. Because what that ultimately leads to is, it leads to the wrong decisions. And those wrong decisions lead to the wrong output for customers. So it leads to businesses cutting customer service jobs, for example, or cutting the ability to invest in technology that empowers customers and gives them the opportunity to have the experience that they're looking for. Whereas if you flipped that on his head and you said, do you know what? We are a customer service business. That's what we are. We just happen to sell stuff. That's a byproduct of what we do. We're not a retailer. We're a customer service business. Then what would they do differently? And I think they would do lots of things differently. And in my framework, you know, there's a lot to that. But one of the most important elements is actually not just empowering customers with the right solutions, it's empowering employees within the business with the right tools to serve customers and give them the experience the best experience that they're looking for. But it also involves putting those people within your business at the heart of the organization, because they're the ones that more often than not have to engage with the customer. And if they don't feel very engaged with what the brand's trying to do, they're unlikely to deliver the appropriate levels of service. So you know, there are 10 steps in my framework, but fundamentally it comes down to flipping the business and flipping the culture of the business from seeing customer service as a cost to seeing it as a benefit.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's that point is really important. And, you know, thinking about that and thinking about the complex nature of those journeys, how do businesses actually demonstrate that? How do they maintain a customer-centric approach in their organizations?
Well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, first of all, one of the challenges is that retailers generally are still quite siloed. So you don't find many businesses that has, you know, an integrated approach to how they deal with customers. It's still very channel-led. You have a store team and they look after the stores. You have a digital team and they look after the web. And, you know, and then you have a separate customer service team, and more often than not, the entities are not joined up. And then you've also got buying teams and merchandising teams and people making decisions about stores and what stores should look like or where the stores should be opened. You know, and the reality is, if you put the customer at the heart of all of this, you said, and you would then say, well, actually, I don't need all these silos. I'm going to join everyone together so that we're all thinking about this collectively. And I think it's about making sure that everyone's on the same path. You know, you hear the term direction of travel. It's making sure everyone knows what the direction of travel is and essentially is aligned with it and subscribed to it and believes in it. And one of the other ways of achieving that is, at the moment, everyone's being measured differently. So generally speaking, again, in those silos, they're all being measured by operating metrics that relate to their part of the business. They don't relate to the customer. They don't relate to putting the customer first. They relate to how many orders did you ship out from the warehouse today? How quickly did you get those goods out the door? How many calls did you take in the contact center? Not how many of those calls in the contact center were answered first time and the customer received a resolution first time, because that's the thing that they should be measuring. They're actually measuring volume rather than, they're measuring quantity rather than quality in many respects across a retail business. And that has to reverse. And I think if you implemented a bunch of KPIs that were much more about the customer, not only would that really help to make sure that everybody was all pointing in the same direction and supporting each other with what they were doing, because everyone had the same objective, which was around being customer-centric and how their part of the business could deliver that. But you'd also be measuring things that give you much more insight about how you're performing. Because the issue with traditional KPIs, and you know, again, your client side, I've been, you know, head of online at Burberry, Harrods, Ted Baker, Pentland Brands. I've sat in thousands of trading meetings on a Monday, and I've had more KPIs than you can shake a stick at. Conversion rates, average order values, units per transaction, traffic, dwell time, abandonment rates, yada, yada, the list goes on. Now, we obviously need to track these, but these are basically outputs, they're not the inputs. What we really need to understand is what's actually affecting these KPIs, and those are primarily around the customer. So whether it's Net Promoter Score, whether it's customer satisfaction, CSAT, you know, the percentage of repeat customers, surveying customers, what do they feel about the experience? You know, these are the things that actually tell us what's going on. And I think if we can address those issues and have a more integrated structure, more synergistic KPIs that are really led by an objective to be customer-centric, then we can make sure everyone's moving in the right direction.
If you allow me just to build on that, we could spend the whole podcast just talking about this one thing, this one question. But all of this, like I said, is not happening in a vacuum, and retailers continue to evolve. They continue to develop and they continue to adapt to a changing world, a changing consumer, a new generation of consumer. So innovation comes into play here as well. And listen, nobody needs another payment method just to process a payment. It works. So why is ClearPay, why is Afterpay different? What benefit am I giving to you, Mr. Retailer, and why should you adopt this? And of course, so it's again back to listening to the consumer and being customer centric, but also evolving your business model, your go-to-market, your website offering, your service provisioning, all that stuff. You know, if you look at us and where we come from, we're not a traditional payments company. We're not a traditional payments provider, although it says pay in the name, ClearPay, Afterpay. We're actually retail tech, not fintech. We're a retail partner, and our founder is not only a serial entrepreneur retailer, but he comes from a retail family. And then on top of that, he is a millennial. And the millennial GZ, when we say that the consumer is at the heart of it, really that next wave of consumer, which is important to the retailer for the next 10 years, is actually a millennial and increasingly the Gen Z. This group will make up 50% of our disposable spend available to retailers over the next 10 years. They're 50% of the workforce, 50% of the economy. And guess what? They shop differently, but they also pay differently. They're shifting away from credit cards, traditional credit. They have a mistrust to traditional banks and traditional credit provisioning. They've seen people get into a debt trap. They don't trust the fine print. And, you know, Visa is quoting numbers that credit card transactions are down 8% in the last 12 months, while debit card transactions are up 22%. So they are choosing to put their spend on a debit card, which of course then constrains you in what you can do. So they're very responsible. They're working. They're living within their means and spending their own money the way they want to spend. By the way, it's also the first generation in the UK that has student debt. And so they're saddled with money that comes out the door before they've even started spending. So then you introduce something like Clearpay, which taps into these not only global trends around digitization, but also a global trend of how consumers want to spend their own money. And by giving them a budgeting tool up front, and by using a debit card, it allows them that little bit of financial flexibility to live the lifestyle that they want in a very controlled manner, where they cannot get into trouble, where they cannot build up a mountain of debt. And so again, consumer is at the center of all these trends. They're happening with COVID. They're potentially even accelerating, certainly the digitization, but also the shift to debit. And then how do we as retailers and service providers layer in our services and adapt to what the needs of the consumers are, not only now, but for the next 10 years?
Brilliant. And a great segue. And I think that, you know, what you've started to do there is really unbox virtually what Clearpay does. And I'm going to come back to you in a minute and really just try and understand from a consumer perspective, what does that actually mean? What do I get? What do I do? How does it all work? A brilliant build on what Martin said there as well. And I'd like to just probably just pick up on to both of you, actually, what brands do you think have actually got this right? So start with you, Martin. If you're talking about customer centricity and you give a great overview of what that means and sort of the key learnings from your white paper, but what brands really have got customer centricity right in your view?
I'm a bit of a hard taskmaster when it comes to evaluating, you know, who's actually done it right. Because I'll be honest with you, I don't see too many businesses doing it well end to end. I see different businesses doing different elements well, whether that's implementing Clearpay because they've recognized that, you know, they've got a millennial and Gen Z customer base who want to pay a different way, you know, or whatever it happens to be. I mean, you take someone like John Lewis. I mean, John Lewis is an interesting one because their partnership model lends itself well to customer service because everyone in that organization at the end of the day has some ownership of the business because that's the model, right? So by default, the employees in the business feel more like shareholders and partners than they do just being an employee in another retail business. So I think most consumers would probably tell you that generally speaking, they've always felt they've had a pretty good level of service there. Saying that, you know, John Lewis is a business that spent £23 million last year on resolving customer service issues, essentially appeasing customers. You know, so rather than maybe taking a very small amount of that and saying, well, let's work out what's going wrong, how we make sure it doesn't happen again. So they're doing the right thing by pacifying customers. But what might they do to make sure these things don't arise in the first place? Sometimes when you look at the pure plays who haven't had the complexity of the established multi-channel businesses, and let's be honest, the complexity, you know, they do have very complex models. These are not easy businesses to turn around. They're not easy businesses to pivot at a challenging time like this, and many of them have done it well. If you look at the pure plays, they haven't had the legacy. They've had the benefit of being able to rewrite, if you like, the business model, the operating model. So you look at a business like AO.com, who used to be appliances online, and you know, from the people that they employ, you know, they're looking from a cultural point of view of people who are ambitious, but they're looking for people who are ultimately humble, because they see the two attributes as being key drivers for delivering great service. Because humility allows someone to accept when they're wrong and hold their hands up. It also makes them better collaborators with other people in the business. But then the ambition also drives them on to want to continue to improve, not only what they're doing themselves, improving themselves, improving how they engage with their colleagues, but in terms of improving the service they deliver. And I think they've thought it through right the way to the last touch point, and arguably the most important, which is when you bought a white goods from AO.com, the people who are installing them are not being incentivized by how many fridge freezers did they install in a day. They're only being incentivized by customer satisfaction. And that is what I was talking about earlier. That metric drives the right behavior, because what you get is a white glove approach. And these mainly men coming into the house with these big bulky pieces of electrical equipment, you know, white goods, but essentially treating the house, the customer's house, as if it was their own, being very careful not to damage anything, you know, making sure that the customer's happy with everything before they leave, because that's what they're being measured on. Whereas if the business had said, forget about that, all I'm bothered about is you need to install twice as many fridge freezers a day as you're doing at the moment, you know what's going to happen, right? The service levels are going to go down, complaints are going to go through the roof, and customers are not going to come back. So one small example of a business that I think plays the long game and thinks very much about customer retention and the importance of great service on making sure people come back.
Yeah, it's a brilliant example. I've used AO.com myself a few times and I can completely resonate with that. Carl, what about yourself? What brands do you see getting that customer centricity piece absolutely right?
Well, you know, it's an excellent question. And I think... you know, I mean, Amazon comes to mind, but actually, so they do a lot of stuff right, but they don't do everything right, as we know. And of course, Amazon has become also a mega, not only retailer, but a mega company that operates in so many different areas that there is not just one Amazon. Likewise, I think if you think of retail and groceries, you know, everyone talks to Ocado and Waitress as doing things right, but, you know, they're not only doing things right because the stores look good and it's premium, but actually if you think of Lidl and Aldi and some of the disruptors, they're also doing things right but in a very different segment. And I think it's about being good at what you do. And then, you know, if you look at the companies that have momentum, it's because they have momentum because consumers are engaging. Consumers are buying and coming back. There's engagement and there's frequency, and that propels growth. And of course, companies that are oftentimes struggling or losing customers, they're losing them for a reason. They're no longer relevant in the offering or in the way that they, you know, see the offering through, right down to the delivery of the fridge freezer. So I think you have everything. And lastly, I think I would just say the ones that embrace change, you know, the big retailers that know that they have to reformat their store, reinvent the offering, you know, tap into the next generation of consumers. I think of M&S, one of our customers, who is obviously a giant on many scales, but also has a increasingly, you know, older demographic. They're in a very public digital transformation process. They're not calling it a turnaround. It's a digital transformation process. They've recognized that they're behind, but they also, and why they're working with us, is they are trying to access that younger consumer. And we have, of course, a high concentration in the UK with 1.5 million active consumers, 80% which are, you know, Gen Z or millennial, and 80% which are female. And so they're tapping into that. So they're embracing that challenge. And I think the ones who do that, and in the COVID, they were all stretched. We were all stretched as individuals and as companies. And you saw some online pure plays that thrived, that did really well. But you also saw some online pure plays that fell down because the warehousing complexity and the logistics of getting stuff out the door in a safe way and actually being able to then also deliver on the promise of, you know, quick deliveries and how do you handle returns. And some of them did it very well because that's what they're really good at. And others actually had to close or partially close their warehouse. So again, I think we get tested in these ways that really test whether we're actually good at what we see or as good as we think we are. And so the last 6 months has been very eye-opening, I think, for all of us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we're going to touch on the last 6 months in a minute or so, because I think, you know, trying to establish what's happened and what trends we've seen during and also coming out of this particular period of time, it'd be great to get both your inputs in. But it was interesting that you mentioned a couple of supermarkets as part of your example there. And I saw, I think, an article this morning, actually, and probably following on from an article you shared last week, Martin, on social media about Asda doing their flu jabs in the car park, which I think was an excellent. I'll get you to explain that in a second. But also this morning I saw that they had launched their first eco store in Leeds and, you know, trying to drive down packaging. So I think you've both mentioned brands that have a purpose and brands that are trying to, you know, make good of the planet is something that really does resonate with today's consumer and tomorrow's consumer as well. So, Martin, just give us a quick overview of that article you shared during the week, which is around the flu jabs. I think you had it as one of your sort of your top recommendations for customer centricity last week.
Well, it's brands being socially responsible, you know, and social responsibility, excuse me, social responsibility doesn't need to mean what you're doing for the environment. A lot of it's about what you're doing for your community. And I think we've seen a lot of examples, you know, during the pandemic of brands who have demonstrated both bad behavior and good behavior. And I just thought Asda was one example of the particularly good behavior, where essentially what they were doing is they were letting customers come and get their flu jab, you know, in the car park of an Asda store. Why? Because it's outside, because they feel safe, and because many customers don't want to go and get their flu jab at their doctors. And, you know, I can relate to that directly, because I'm due to go on Saturday morning to get my flu jab. And the idea of walking back into my doctor's for the first time in about 8 months is not a good one. You know, I'm kind of thinking, well, what's that process going to be like? And I'm sure they're probably just as nervous about having me come in as I am going in. So I think it was just a great example of, you know, addressing a concern that they recognize that consumers might have, and them playing their part in making life a little bit easier for customers that need to get a flu jab. It was nothing about, you know, I don't believe that it had, you know, a commercial objective at the heart of it. I believe it was just the right thing to do and something they felt they wanted to do. And I think it's great. You know, I think it says a lot about the brand.
I think it absolutely does. And you see a lot of that through the last 6 to 8 months, 7 years of brands really stepping up and doing things differently to support people. So let's pivot and focus a little bit more on that. Carl, coming to you, there's been a lot going on over the last 6 to 8 months, and clearly we're not out of the woods yet. What have you seen brands do to really show centricity through the pandemic?
Yeah, I think just to build on what Martin said, it, you know, for whatever motivation Asda did that, but it's putting the consumer or the community at the center, and it's tapping into a trend of a reality of something that's happening around us. And how agile are you as a business to adapt to that? So to your question, we've seen a lot. We've seen the reemergence or the importance of the local high street or the SMBs. Now, small businesses play an important role with Clearpay. On any day, we have 55,000 retailers on the platform. So by definition, most of them are SMBs. We have the big global brands, but we have a long, long list of small businesses. And again, shopping locally and having some of those small businesses pivot online, having businesses that otherwise were sort of B2B or supplier-led going direct to consumer. I think it's a trend we're seeing also with the big brands, from the big brands that used to distribute and still distribute through other retailers and department stores, but also going direct. And again, using the online as a channel. Again, as the world closes and online becomes your only channel in a lockdown, that becomes more important for a business, whether you're super big or you're small. So the pivoting the business, going digital, going direct, the mix shift, we deal mainly in fashion, beauty, lifestyle, and accessories. Well, no one's going to a party in a lockdown. Gone is the black party dress. So how do you now, what are you going to start selling? So it's the products that are relevant to the lockdown. We saw a shift. We saw the shift on certain businesses that we work with much quicker than others. You know, gone are the like I said, the party dresses, and up come the throws, the blankets, the candles, the athletic wear. So the whole mix changes. And as suppliers, to this industry, we also had to adapt our product and our product offering and how we engage. So I think it's, again, being quick on your feet, and good retailers, you know, businesses that know how to survive, they do this.
Yeah, brilliant. Great examples. And it's fascinating to hear how those behaviors changed during the pandemic. Martin, same to you, but also, you know, building on that, what do you see as the sort of key trends for commerce moving forward using that backdrop?
At a structural level, excuse me, quite significant impact, obviously, because we went into the pandemic with 19% of all retail being conducted online, and we're currently sitting at 26%. So we've seen 45% or thereabouts growth, sustained growth. In other words, it's not going to drop from there. Now, obviously, during the height of lockdown, it would have been probably closer to 80% because it was only groceries that we were buying offline because all non-essential retail was closed. So e-commerce has become massively more important now to any organization, particularly multi-channel retailers. And so I think, you know, we're going to continue to see rationalization of the store portfolio. You're going to see retailers closing stores. I'm not an advocate, nor am I suggesting for a second that the physical retail is going away, because it's still 74% of total retail as we sit here today. But I do think that it's fair to say that over the last 10 or 15 years, retailers overextended their store portfolio in the first place. So that shift to online has big implications for logistics, big implications for customer service, has implications for marketing, content, and so many other elements. So lots of things that retailers are going to have to think about in terms of where they put their resources and what they're investing in order to deliver the right type of experience moving forwards. Just touching on what Carl was saying in terms of changes to consumer behavior, and he's obviously on the money, and Clearpay has incredible amount of data that it's seeing around this. But I do think that whilst consumers are not buying the black dress today and they're not buying the party outfit today, we may well see the opposite when we come out of this, because you know what's going to happen. We're all going to go absolutely mental. We're all going to be out clubbing and going to as many parties, as many corporate events, as many hospitality events, as many football matches, as many weddings, funerals and bar mitzvahs, maybe not the funerals, as we can possibly get our hands on, right?
We're going especially in Scotland.
Exactly. And we don't all wear kilts. So some of us need something else to wear as well, right? So I think that it probably will swing from one extreme to the other. But of course, whilst formal wear has been the, not the beneficiaries, whilst formal wear has unfortunately suffered as a result of lockdown, the beneficiaries have been, you know, loungewear and fitness and all the other brands that have done really well. So there's been a really interesting change. And I think that obviously some of what's happened will be a lasting change and some of it's temporary. And the whole work from home thing, I mean, you know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, if you asked the majority of people in the UK how they felt about working from home now, most of them would probably say, do you know, actually, I probably quite like this. You know, that I'm missing out on one or two things, but I quite like it. And I think if you ask people now, I think they'll say, do you know what, I can't wait to get back to the office. Now, I think what will happen is we'll have a hybrid model and people will go in a couple of days a week, 3 days a week, and then spend, you know, either 2 or 3 days working from home, and they'll have their team meetings, whatever else in the office, and then they'll do some of their own individual tasks working from the home environment. But that has a big impact because that shifts demand. Because if you're working at home half the week, then you haven't got access to a lot of the brands you would normally get access to. So you're either going to switch your demand to online, or you might buy locally because you're spending more time shopping locally. So that's been to the benefit of independent retailers. And I keep saying to national retailers, you know, that I think there's an opportunity for national chains to open up small format, localized stores, pop-ups. You know, there's a lot of empty spaces. They could easily, John Lewis as an example, or M&S, could have even smaller format stores. Yeah, I live in High Barnet. I mean, there is an M&S not far away. But there must be opportunities for the big corporates to take the brand into more local areas and behave more like an independent retailer and take advantage of this kind of move towards staying more locally. So these are some of the things that I think will transpire.
I think that's a brilliant idea, Martin. And I think, I think, again, the grocery stores have kind of led on that with the Metro Tesco and the local Sainsbury's. And, you know, I think, you know, going just because you're national and big doesn't mean you can't go small. And I think local communities appreciate that.
Brilliant insight. Thank you very much indeed. Now, I think probably what everyone's sitting there thinking with all this information is, what do I actually do now? So brands may be sitting there thinking, do you know what? There's some great insight here. How do I take the first step? What is the next best step for me to take? So probably come to you both really in terms of like, what's your top tip? What can brands do now to deliver customer centricity? So Carl, I'll come to you first.
Oh, well, that's it's at any point in time a difficult question, but in these very uncertain times and the build up to Christmas and the most important, you know, period of the calendar, October, November, and the shopping season, I think there's some unknowns around that and how that's going to play out. Have people started shopping already? I think because people have traveled less, have spent less in restaurants, have, you know, gone to less festivals over the summer, there's actually more disposable income available, but they've also obviously started to shop online in a different way. We've seen a massive surge, an increase in online spend. You know, how will Christmas play out? How will Black Friday play out? Lots of retailers have excess inventory. They're already discounting. So I think a lot of unknowns. What I would say is continue what you do and do it really well. I think if we think we're going to live for the next 6 months, possibly longer, in this prolonged uncertainty of, you know, lockdown, partial lockdown, on, off, I think you just have to assume that it's going to be that way. And so you have to continue to perfect what you do around offering the relevant products to the consumer, offering the relevant services, including payment options like ClearPay, to the consumer, making it easy, making sure that your warehousing, your logistics, and your delivery and your customer service is tight as can be. Plan in, so start early, start your Christmas sales early, because actually you got to plan in logistics headaches, not least because of Brexit. If you're a UK retailer and dependent on supply that goes into Europe or back or vice versa, and then the returns at the end of that to also handle that. So I would say start early. Start early would be my number one recommendation for, you know, the next 12 months.
Brilliant. Thanks, Carl. Martin?
I've mentioned it already. I would basically say, think of yourself as a customer service business. Forget what you sell. Almost make that an irrelevance. That doesn't mean not to focus on having the right product. But, you know, take that as a given that you've got the right products. But think first and foremost of yourself as a customer service business, and walk across every part of your organization and every decision you're making, and think about, is that absolutely the right thing to do for the customer? Is that going to drive the right outcome? Is how we are working internally, as I mentioned earlier, going to drive the right outcome for our customers? And I think that what you'll do off the back of that is you'll engender yourself far more to them from a service perspective. You'll engage more with them and you'll mean more to them, because you'll communicate in a more transparent way. You'll deliver better levels of service. You'll demonstrate you've got the right type of culture that those customers want to engage with. And I think that's a great starting point. Breaking it down into just some of the bullets, I've talked about empowerment. So it's empowerment of customers, giving them the tools to enable them to shop how they want. You know, whether that's click and collect, whether that's clear pay for buy now, pay later, whether that's, you know, live chat, whatever it happens to be. So there's customer empowerment, there's staff empowerment, there's encouraging your people to be able to deliver levels of service on the front line that makes a difference to customers. Again, I talked earlier about AO.com. They empower their customer service team to make decisions up to £500. They don't have to go and speak to a supervisor. They can just make a decision. And that instantaneous resolution of a customer issue makes all the difference in how they feel about that brand. And I think I'd finish off with just talking about purpose. And I think purpose and social responsibility have never been more important. And I think that a brand today that can demonstrate to its customers, to its prospective customers, and to the community at large that it really cares, and that it's giving back and it's doing something for its community at a time like this, when we're all shell-shocked and we've never been through anything like this in our entire life, that's a brand that will really resonate. But it's something that you have to live and breathe. And, you know, it's not good enough just to do something as an isolated measure, i.e. turn over your supply chain to, instead of creating trench coats, you know, creating PPE gowns, the NHS, that's a really great start and it's a great thing to do. But how can you go further than that? And how can you demonstrate to consumers and the community at large that you are a brand that has a purpose? You're not just there to make money. And I think that that will be the heart of the success of brands who stand the test of time over the next 20 years.
I 100% agree. Thank you both very, very much indeed for all your insights across the whole of the cast. I think there's been some amazing tips and discussion points, and I can't thank you enough for giving up the time to chat to us today. How do people, we'll put this in the bio as well for the podcast, but how do people get in touch with you? So first of all, Martin, how do people reach out to you?
They can email me, martin@martinnewman.co.uk. They can reach me on Twitter, which is just @martinnewman, or they can find me on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. And Carl?
Yeah, email me, carl.scheibel@clearpay.co.uk or LinkedIn, Carl Scheibel, and look forward to engaging with anyone who has a question.
Fantastic. Thank you both very, very much indeed. Really appreciate your time.
Cheers, Graham. Thank you. Cheers, Carl.
Thank you. Well, that's all we've got time for episode number 2 of the Think Omnichannel podcast. Thanks very much to my guests, Martin Newman and Carl Scheibel, for their excellent insights and really uncovering the topic of customer centricity around omnichannel transformation. Really brilliant stuff. And I hope you took as much from it as I did personally. And talking about that, our next guest has just successfully defended her thesis for her PhD. And that is entitled Omnichannel Transformation. So we're actually going to be speaking to the Doctor of Omnichannel on episode 3. Really looking forward to that. And the best way to make sure you don't miss that episode or any other future episodes is to subscribe to this podcast on all of your favorite podcast platforms. And if you wouldn't mind sharing your thoughts with us, either directly to me, graham@thinkomnichannel.com, or leaving a review on any of the podcast platforms that you do listen to them. And if you like the podcast, we'd love you to share it on your social media platforms so we can build the audience and have as many people take as much from these podcasts as possible. If you listen to this thinking you could contribute as well, or you'd like to be a guest, then again, please email me, graham@thinkomnichannel.com, and follow me on Twitter at The Omni Guy. So that's @TheOmniGuy. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. Take care. Bye-bye.